University Forum is a presentation of Nebraska Wesleyan University, which brings speakers to the campus to lecture on a variety of topics. The opinions expressed by the speakers do not necessarily represent the opinions of Nebraska Wesleyan University or of this station. Today, University Forum presents Hermosa, South Dakota writer and rancher Linda Hasselstrom and her lecture, Reaping Literature from the Western Plains. In Dakota Arts Quarterly, Hasselstrom was described as being able to deliver a calf and a poem on the same day after mending a fence. A full-time rancher who has spent virtually all of her life in South Dakota, she has written several books, including nonfiction, poetry, and collections of essays. Her first book, Windbreak, A Woman Rancher on the Northern Plains, is written from an almost daily journal she has been keeping since she was 9 years old. A book of essays titled Going Over East, Reflections of a Woman Rancher, won the first American Writing Award by Fulcrum Incorporated. My ranch work and environmental activities have always found their way into my writing, Hasselstrom says. I see the plains as the final frontier, and in danger of utter destruction if it serves more populous areas, only as an energy reservoir, a source of labor, and a waste repository. In addition to her work as a writer and rancher, Hasselstrom also serves as a teacher and consultant on writing and publishing. She received her bachelor's degree from the University of South Dakota and a master's from the University of Missouri at Columbia. Join us now for University Forum with Linda Hasselstrom, Reaping Literature from the Western Plains.
Gee, you hardly need me to say anything after an introduction like that. I ought to have the good sense to just go home. Not ruin your illusions. Bill mentioned that one of those awards involved money. And that's about right. But one of them. But the governor's award for achievement in the arts, I have to say, was one of my favorite ones because someone let slip that not only was it going to be awarded in the Capitol building of the state of South Dakota, but that if I wanted to, I could say a few words. And I am told that the governor went white twice during my talk, which pleased me no end. He was seated behind me and I couldn't see him, but I took the opportunity to say that I construed the award as a vindication of my environmental stance, and since the governor has been working vigorously to develop South Dakota by bringing in garbage from New Jersey, and I have been working vigorously against that, this was not a polite thing to say, and I haven't been invited back to the Capitol since, but it was worth it. I want to open with a piece of an essay called Rock Lover that's in The Whole Earth Review, which is a wonderful and weird magazine out of Berkeley, California. This essay will be in my next book, which is, Bill said, it's forthcoming. I had hoped to have a paste-up proof of it here this morning, but it didn't forthcome in quite soon enough, given the U.S. Postal Service. White and pink quartz chunks show up on the dun-colored prairie because of their unusual color. I can't help picking them up, but reserve them for special use, decorating the graves of cats that were good mousers, or the grave of Cahoolan, the West Highland white terrier buried near my house. When we were away from home, he always stood at a particular spot on the hill to wait for us. We'd see his square little white body in the flicker of our headlights. We buried him on that spot, and now the white quartz catches my eye from a distance, day or night. Intermingled with the quartz on these graves and set as a border around the few flower beds I keep free of grass are bones, cow and horse skulls, ribs, leg bones, T-bones, single vertebrae graduated in size from as large as my fist to as small as a fingertip. I began by collecting Frodo, he's my current Westie, Frodo's gnawed, unburied leftovers from a desire for tidiness and whimsically putting them on Cahoolan's grave. I've always liked the shapes and textures of bones and began as a child picking them up in the pasture or boneyard for the pleasure of looking at and touching them. When my collection outgrew my study walls and bookshelves, I used them to mark the sites of special plants and to create bone borders for particular plants. Bone borders, there's a symbolism in those words. In each epoch of any land, the borders of the known world have been strewn with the bones of those who tried to penetrate the wilderness, the explorers who dared more. Though we make a fetish of erecting monuments to the admired few among our heroes, the breadth of these plains were seeded with the bones of those courageous ones whose names we have forgotten, but whose paths we follow still, literally and figuratively. Bury me deep, pleaded a dying child on the pioneer trail to Oregon, so the wolves will not dig me up. But no matter how deeply in the flesh of her mother earth they buried her, she remained alive in her living mother's heart, and her bones could not escape their fate. Bones decay, dissolve back into the richness of the earth. It pleases me to watch them weather through the seasons, to contemplate the length of time these bones will last in comparison to the fragility of human bones and in contrast to the rocks I move. That's just a small segment of that essay, but I was reminded of it because every time I come to Nebraska and drive along the Platte River, I remember how much of our history, the history of the whole country, has gone back and forth along that passageway since man first came to these plains. And yet, in terms of the national culture, if you were to take a cross-section of it in our magazines or our television, life on the Great Plains is not really a very big part of what we see as our national culture. And I think it's very important for those of us who are here writing and reading not to forget that even though the nation does not take much notice of us except during election years, our culture is really a basis for a lot that goes on in this country. And to help our children understand that the varied lives we live out here are very valid, even though they don't get much validation from the national culture. When I talk about my writing, and the title of this piece is Reaping Literature from the Plains, and I think there are a great many of us that are doing that, but I have to primarily talk about myself because that's the only thing I'm even moderately sure of, and of course, half the time I'm not entirely sure what I'm doing. But I think it's important to continue to do it as an example to other people who live here of how important life is here and how much beauty and literature and poetry and art and music can be made of the lives that we live here. And to keep some of us here to validate that. I talk in the next book, which is called Land Circle. They wanted to call it Collected Writings, and I said, Collected Writings means you're dead. And I just don't feel quite that far gone. So they switched it and said, Writings Collected from the Land. And I like that a little bit better. But I talk about the fact that the Great Plains, I think, is the third and last frontier. Again, it's been a frontier before. We've got a lot of homeless and jobless people on both coasts. We have a lot of new ethnic groups. We have a lot of corporations that are after various kinds of economic benefits. And out here we have a lot of space, a lot of minerals, and a lot of place to put garbage if my governor prevails. Farms and ranches, we might have the last grizzly bear. And we also have a lot of economic problems, and sometimes we're desperate enough to take garbage if we can't get anything else. And I think it's one of the things I worked on in that book is trying to remind us of some of the choices we're going to have to make. And I think all of these interests are going to conflict in the next 50 years very strongly. And therefore, I think our writers And the people who speak for us are going to become very important to us in the next few years. And even those of us who would just as soon not be very political are going to have to make some choices and help guide our choices. In the introduction to Going Over East, which is where I first started exploring in essay form the contradictions of being a rancher and an environmentalist in the Great Plains, I wrote about how I got into this position. My father announced that we were going over east to get the cows out of summer pasture. The day was cold and blustery. He and my mother and I climbed into the green 1949 Chevrolet truck, and we still have it, and headed out over the brown plains. He would stop at a gate, get out, open it, get back in the truck, drive through the gate, get out, close the gate, and get back in. I hadn't yet learned that opening gates was going to be one of my jobs. Off in the distance were the knife-sharp ridges of the Badlands, looking blue and icy. It seemed to me we drove for hours, and the Badlands slowly got closer until we slipped down into a small valley, still green, with the clouds low and gray above us. Then my mother shifted the pickup into super low and led the cattle while my father and I walked behind them. Before long, snow began to fall heavily, muffling all sound and cutting off my view at the tops of the low hills nearby. I could hear nothing but the moaning wind, see nothing but a few brown and white cows who looked at me, snorted, then turned and ran ahead. Suddenly, I felt very small, alone, and terrified, until dimly, I saw the tall, slightly bent figure of my father, almost lost in the blowing snow. He was striding along, looking sure of where he was and where he was going. Now, 35 years later, that stooped figure still dominates the ranch and going over east. I've realized since what I only suspected that day, that someone who pays attention to the messages that the natural world sends can bring cattle home the day before a blizzard, 9 times out of 10. It's a matter of instinct, experience, self-reliance. I had no landmarks in the blizzard. Similarly, I found few rules in the business of ranching. You learn by doing it. And that, of course, is exactly the same way you learn how to be a writer. You learn by doing it. I always read one poem by another author when I do a reading, but I don't usually start with it. And I decided to do that today. Place marker, thank you, Twyla. Because what this writer says has a great deal to do with the theme of what I'm going to try to be conveying with my work today. This is from a wonderful collection by edited by Mark Sanders, who was at Nebraska Wesleyan until recently, called The Decade Dance. It's by a writer from South Dakota named David Dwyer. The title of it is Metaphysics. Now, listen closely for the Lakota words, because not only are they very important and they are translated in the poem, but we have often left the Lakota, the early inhabitants of the plains, out of our calculations. And I think that, as usual, what they say is sometimes very central to what we're doing. Called Metaphysics. Once in a seedy mafia bar near where my father used to live, I saw a woman walk in silver shoes and a black G-string among empty tables to a silent jukebox. She popped a quarter in. I turned away, still cold from the world where it was snowing. My father was away. I'd come up from the city to see him. I was 25. All my childhood, I always knew where both my parents were, and now I did not. That is the difference, I said to myself. And gin, I said to the bartender, splash a tonic. Rock and roll. She had begun to dance in the rosy light across the dark room. 4 or 5 other men hunched on their stools by the door and did not look at her or each other. I hunched among them, staring in my glass. I want to say we were ashamed, that for shame at our silly sex, we could not look at her. But really, I was afraid. I have made her, in memory, a terrifying beauty, golden-skinned, Diana among low, moonstruck dogs. But really, I do not know. I was afraid to look at her. 3 songs and silence again. She walked to the far end of the bar and slipped a dark cloak on, a monk's robe almost. In memory, I have made it the color of dried blood, but really, I do not know. I was afraid to look. Outside, it snowed on my childhood, of course, and on the gutted warehouse across the street. 15 years before, I saw it burn on a snowy night. Another quick gin, and I went to take a leak. I had to walk by her. She hunched on her stool, her naked hand propping up a book on the bar. Also Sprach Zarathustra, I read, and turned away. This doesn't sound true, even to me. Nonetheless, it is the case. The world is everything that is the case. The snow on my father's empty house, the old geography I knew by heart, the invisible woman, rosy light and darkness, German metaphysics. So, that bar's been gone for years, and the rundown block of flats behind it I've just remembered. Mark Twain Apartments, it said, above the crooked door that opened on a dirty hall of which I was afraid. I don't know where my father is. I am afraid of different things these days. I hope she is happy. I hope she is however beautiful she cares to be, however wise, a philosopher, a woman of the world. Inyan Wakan, an old Lakota woman told me once in another sleazy bar in Chamberlain, South Dakota, Oyate e Wakan, the rocks are holy. Even this world is holy. I think that's a wonderful poem for what I'm thinking about today. Even this world is holy. Even the sleazy bars and the strippers and the embarrassed men and being afraid. And when I was thinking about what I was going to read, I had titled this talk, Reaping Literature from the Plains. But the more I thought about that word reaping, the less I liked it, because reaping implies planting, which in eastern Nebraska implies plowing and chemical fertilizers and irrigation and great big harvesting machines that take up two-thirds of the road. And as I grow more convinced that sustainable agriculture is the only way that we're going to be able to continue to use the plains for food and not turn them into another dust bowl, I get less comfortable with modern agriculture. So I've retitled the talk, Hunting and Gathering Literature from the Plains, which goes back to our history and probably is more nearly what we actually do or what I do as a writer and what I think a lot of writers do. And one of the things that you can hunt and gather from the plains are some of the stories that would be lost if we writers don't write them down. And this is called Homesteading in Dakota. This is a poem I do not read in South Dakota. I'm taking a chance reading it this close. It was a typical prairie homestead, 160 dusty acres with not one tree. Mr. Fisher put up a soddy for his wife, 5 kids, and dug a well by hand the first month. The kids and the woman worked the winch after the well got below 10 feet. He cut logs in the hills 10 miles away for a solid barn, log-roofed. Once they were settled, he went to the mines in Deadwood, 70 miles away, for winter cash. She stayed in the soddy, milked the cow, dug out a little garden, struggling with the sod laced together by buffalo grass roots. Now and then she'd stop for breath, shade her eyes, look at the horizon line drawn smooth against the sun. Mr. Fisher, she called him that, came home when he could, once or twice a month all summer. Neighbors helped her catch the cow, fight fire, sit up when the youngest child died. Once he got a late start, rode in at midnight. Fumbling at the low door, he heard struggle inside. The kids were all awake, pale, blank faces hanging in the dark. When he pushed aside the curtain to the double bunk, he saw the window open, a white-legged form running in the moonlight, his wife's screaming face. He shot once out the window, missed, shot her and didn't. The neighbors said Black Douglas, on the next claim, walked for a month like he had cactus in his feet. The kids grew up wild as coyotes. He never went to trial. He'd done his best. Not his fault the dark spoiled his aim the first time. True story. True story. The Great Plains. And here's another one. This one, let's see, provided of course I could find it. This one is kind of a combination of a number of different stories. It's really embarrassing when you can't find your own. This is a combination of a number of different stories I'd heard from ranchers, and it stayed sort of unfinished for quite a long time. And then I finally got the end of it by reading a newspaper story. This is called Rancher Roulette. It's no trick to get killed ranching. You might get a foot caught in the stirrup when your horse bucks. Get dragged to death. That's what happened to my half-brother. He was riding that ridge to the south there. His wife found him after the storm. Or tip the tractor over on a slope. Or forget to turn off the power takeoff and get your pants leg caught. That happened to a neighbor back in the 40s. By the time his kids saw the tractor circling, he wasn't any bigger than a baseball. Just wound him right around it. Or you could get bit by a rattler fixing fence. I killed one with my shoe once. Clean forgot that left my foot sort of vulnerable. Knew a fella ended up in a dam, drowned. Folks said he must have fell off his horse and hit his head. But he was courting the daughter of a man who didn't like him much. A horse can kick you in the head. You can get hit by a bull or stomped by a cow that just calved. I got thrown from my horse one time, well, more than that. But this one time, I was knocked out, and when I woke up, my head was between two rocks. If I'd hit either one, my head would have popped like a watermelon. Knew a guy fell off the windmill once. He was fixing it, and the wind come up. Kind of jammed his hips up somewhere around his ears. I damn near drowned trying to get a rope under a cow stuck in a mud hole. She thrashed around and pushed me under. I finally lassoed her head and drug her out that way. She died anyway, broke her back. Freezing to death would be easy. After I fell in the creek chopping ice, I damn near died before I could get 50 feet to the pickup. It makes a person wonder if there ain't some other way to make a living. I heard the other day lightning struck a fella's place on his 54th birthday. Killed 54 cows standing under a tree. He said, I hope I don't live to be 100. I can't afford it. All of those, of course, are things that happened either to me or to some of my friends and neighbors and my father. And the ranching business, of course, is serious, not only because you can get killed doing it, but so is the writing business. But it's very hard to get ranchers to take the writing business seriously. Maybe because you don't very often get killed as a result of what you write. But in the introduction to my first collection of poetry, Caught by One Wing. My father still isn't speaking to me over this subject, but I told a story. I frequently put together branding crews composed of a lot of my friends who are interested in experiencing what it's like to brand, and many of them are artists and poets and haven't had a great deal of experience doing this. They're enthusiastic, but sometimes you have odd spectacles, people throwing up over the fence and things like that. And on one occasion, my father usually stays far, far away from these events, but on one occasion he had to pass through the corral about the time a calf got loose. And these, at this particular time, these were pretty good-sized calves, 300 or 400-pound calves. And one of the poets was kind of swinging a lariat, and he threw it at the calf, not thinking, of course, he would hit him. And this is the only time you ever catch one. And he roped the calf right around the neck and was proceeded to be dragged around the corral. And the rest of us, as soon as we stopped giggling, ran after the calf and flung ourselves on it and were trying to get the calf down. And I remember that the calf rolled me over two or three times and my glasses went one direction. And finally we got the calf subdued. And I looked over, and my father was standing in the corner of the corral. He just shook his head and walked on out. Next day he went to town to see his insurance agent, and he said, Am I insured against poets? And I think that's fairly typical of the way people view this profession. But what I find odd is that frequently people suggest that I go into another line of work. And I really like the combination of mental and physical labor. After my first book, Windbreak, was the subject of copyright infringement by a romance writer who made three times as much money by copying passages from it as I made from publishing in the first place, not to mention writing it and living it, a lot of people suggested that I start writing romances. They said, it'd be easy and you can make so much more money. And I think this is odd because people, you don't go up to your minister on Sunday morning and say, you know, you could make a lot more money, Rev, if you'd be a stockbroker. People always used to ask me, what does your husband think of your writing? Now, have you ever asked a nuclear physicist, what does your wife think of your job? I think it's odd, and that writing is one of the few things that this happens. And in my case, I didn't have a choice. I'm a compulsive writer. I can't help it. My husband used to say, when Linda's not writing, she's not happy, and when Linda's not happy, nobody's happy. And this poem is kind of an illustration of how I managed to combine the two by writing even when I'm ranching and ranching even when I'm writing, I guess. It's called Hands. The words won't come right from my hands in spring. The fields are full of baby calves, tufts of hay, bawling cows. My brain is full, but words won't come. Sometimes when I'm in the truck, leading heifers to spring grass, I find a stub of pencil, tear a piece from a cake sack, and make notes listening to the curlew's wolf whistle. A barb tore that knuckle when I shut a gate without my gloves. The blood blister came when someone slammed a gate on the branding table. I tore the fingernail fixing a flat. The poems are in the scars, and in what I will recall of all this when my hands are too battered to do it anymore. Instead of a pencil, my hands, knotted like old wood, grip a pitchfork, blister on the handles of a tiller. Slick with milk and slobber, they hold a calf, push the cow's tit into his mouth, feel his sharp teeth cut my fingers. Another scar. My hands pour cake for the yearlings, seed for the garden to feed my family. My hands become my husband's, weathering into this job he chose by choosing me. My father's, cracked and aged, still strong as when he held me on my first horse. All night, while the rest of my body sleeps, my hands will weave some pattern I do not recognize, waving to blackbirds and meadowlarks, skinning a dead calf, picking hayseeds from my hair and underwear, building fires. Deftly, they butcher a chicken with skill my brain does not recall. Maybe they are no longer mine, but grandmother's, back from the grave with knowledge in their bones and sinews, hands scarred as the earth they came from and to which they have returned. When my grandmother was dying, when the body and brain were nearly still for the first time in 80 years, she snatched the tubes from her arms. At the end, her hands wove the air, setting the table, feeding farmhands, sewing patches. Her hands kept weaving the air, weaving the strands she took with her into the dark. One of the things people ask frequently about this lifestyle is how do you find time to write? And in Windbreak, there's a passage where I began to get a handle on some of the things you have to do, some of the decisions you have to make to be a writer. This is from May 20th. The Newcastle Writers Club had asked me to do an all-day workshop on writing and had drawn people from all over the state to it. I talked about children's writing, poetry, fiction, self-publishing, sending manuscripts out, copyright, virtually everything. The first question is always, how do you find time to write? I'm always polite because I know people have varied priorities, and most of these women are wives, mothers, and or grandmothers. But I want to shout, don't have children, don't clean the house, tear the telephone off the wall, throw a brick through the TV, say no, say it again, all together now, no, 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 I will not bring a hot dish to the Ladies' Aid Society meeting. I will not pick up your child or your cleaning. I will not serve on a committee, no matter how high-minded its purpose. I say none of these things because I say yes far too often. And one of the things that my husband often used to do when I was on the telephone saying yes was stand over in the corner and say, I want to read you just to give you a little touch of what windbreak is like, read you part of the 3 days that I have been here in Lincoln from the year of windbreak. October 2nd, low 27, high 40. The geese and cranes are going south this morning in great dark skeins, and I hear faint honkings and hootings that sound wild even here on the plains. I lay on the porch for a while watching the shifting, overlapping bees. Just as I was about to go inside, I noticed a meadowlark sitting on a post about to sing. Suddenly, he shot into the air and seemed to explode. Another moment and I saw a falcon like the one the cats caught, beating back into higher air, clutching the meadowlark in his claws. He struck so fast I didn't see him coming, and neither did the meadowlark. A few yellow breast feathers drifted to earth. It was a harsh lesson, but fitting. We saved the falcon from the cats so he could go on about his life, which happens to include killing and eating meadowlarks. In the afternoon, I saw the seven deer we watch each winter in their favorite spot, the dry dam below the house, and four antelope on the hillside. October 3rd, low 43, high 60. Father went over east to check the cattle so we could have another day of wood cutting. I love the woods this time of year. The leaves are soft and damp underfoot. Red and gold vines wind around the trees. Sunlight flashes among the branches. October 4th, low 45, high 62. I dreamed last night I was having a baby. I knew it was George's, so I was happy and relaxed. The worry had dissolved that it would be deformed because of George's radiation. I felt no pain, just amazement as I looked down at the huge mound of my belly. The nurse came in, checked the dilation, and told the doctor I was ready. Laughing and joking with George, I placed my feet in the stirrups while the doctor gathered his tools. In a moment, he handed me the baby, Michael, who was George's son. I began to cry because he wasn't my child anyway. I woke up crying, and George sleepily held me while I tried to explain why. At breakfast, he asked me if I'd like to adopt a child. I don't often think of not having children, and I really believe I am happier without them. Yet it seems unfair not to be able to have a child of my own with George. Usually, I can get rid of these maternal feelings by spending an hour with a child in diapers. I wanted to read that passage partly because it contained the thing about the falcon, and very often I will write something either in my journal or in prose that then goes on to become a poem later on. And I want to read you the poem that came out of that passage. It's called What the Falcon Said. Flat on his back, feathers bloody, surrounded by drooling cats, the young falcon hissed, clacked his beak, clawed air. His feathers were bloody. One cat licked a bleeding ear. Falcon's yellow eyes didn't blink when I picked him up, like a handful of springs, like a grenade with the pin pulled. None of the blood was his. I put him high in a cedar tree. He clutched the branch and patted, panted, glared at me, then shot straight up like a bullet. Next day on my horse, I saw a red-winged blackbird whistling on a post explode in the middle of a fluid run of song. The falcon shot away, clutching the corpse. He screeched once, but I heard what he said. Don't expect pretty lies from me. I know my job. You saved me from the cats so I could live. I kill to eat. So do the cats. So do you. There's a number of poems that I've written lately kind of on that theme. The main rule of the writer is write what you know, and of course what you know changes as you go through life. And as a meat eater, I am sometimes also in the minority among environmentalists as well as being a rancher. So I have found myself writing a number of poems on that theme, and this is one that'll be in the next book called Beef Eater. I have been eating beef hearts all my life. I split the smooth maroon shape lengthwise, open it like a diagram, chambers exposed. I cut tough white membranes off valves, slice onions over the heart, float it in water, boil it tender. I chop prunes, apricots, mushrooms to mix with dry bread, sage from the hillside. I pack the crevices full, nail that heart together, weave string around the nails. Gently, I lift the full heart between my hands, place it in the pan with its own blood, fat, juices. I roast that heart at 350 degrees for an hour or two. Often, I dip pan juices, pour them lovingly over the meat. When I open the oven, the heart throbs in its own golden fat. I thicken the gravy with flour, place the heart with love on my grandmother's ironstone platter, slice it evenly from the small end, pour gravy over it all, smile as I carry it to the table. My friends have begun to notice my placid air, which they mistake for serenity. Yesterday, a man remarked on my large brown eyes, my long eyelashes, my easy walk. I switched my tail at him as if he were a fly and paced deliberately away. As I said, what you know changes as you get older, so you have a constantly changing variety of things to write about. And lately what I know has come to include death after the death of my husband 3 years ago, which is, some people have seemed to think that this was kind of a switch from writing about the plains, but of course death is a universal topic since, aside from birth, it is the only thing we are absolutely sure that we will all share. And so a lot of my work has been about death, even to the extent that I was not sure I would be able to keep writing for a while. This is a poem that I wrote very soon after George died. George's poem required few words. Even dying, he kept it simple. Be happy. Watch the sunsets. What kind of philosophy is that to get me through the next 40 years? I have to figure it out by myself, but that's not new. He believed I could. He helped me up if I fell, but he didn't grab my arm when I strode ahead. When I cried and clung to him on his hospital bed, he muttered, "Don't get too poetic." George's poem is one doe standing knee-deep in Slate Creek. She scratches an ear with a shiny wet hoof. A man and woman read in sunlight on a lichen-covered rock, rearing out of autumn snow. Near a blue tent, a white dog chases gophers. Walking at dusk, they hear a fawn wail in fear and cold. All night, the dog sleeps between them. At dawn, snow collapses the tent. Entangled, they all crawl out, laughing, throw snowballs, make coffee. The fawn's tracks cross the meadow beside his mother's. Now he is dead, I remember how he smiled as he drank coffee. He was writing a poem with no words. I cannot read it in a book. No one else will ever read it at all. And then 6 months later, I wrote another poem when I began to realize that life goes on, however reluctant we might be about it at the time. This is called the Glacier on Crystal Lake. The stomach of a mammoth found entombed in ice contained yellow buttercups from her last meal. It's a little epigram. I have no idea what that has to do with the poem. Yeah, no, I actually don't. I've sat in a leaky boat over the blue line for 6 months, anchored, staring at the glacial face of your life. It's all there, layers of dust, years of deep snowfall, pictures from your childhood, frozen. Last night, your grandfather died. The glacier calved. A chunk of ice the size of a house rocked my fragile shell, floats beside me now, melting, spinning in blue water. Pieces of your life are growing smaller as I watch. Soon I will unship the oars, row back to the village. Tonight, by trembling oil lamps smaller than my cupped hand, I will tell your stories. How your grandfather took you fishing, eating cinnamon rolls and drinking RC Cola, built an ice boat to sail Crystal Lake, ran from the bees, through the orchard, down the hill, up to the barn loft, and finally into the lake. Later, when the oil burns low, I'll tell alone the stories we told together, yours and mine. After the lamps go out, in the warm, rustling dark, I will whisper new stories that will be mine alone. Far in the ocean, the color of your eyes, the glacier will crash and rumble into the deep. I kind of got on a kick of funeral poems and death poems and things like that for a while. And quite a number of those are in the next book, but also there's a transitional period. And I had mentioned to a couple of people yesterday that in this next book, I hope I have offended nearly everyone. Funeral homes, Christians, all sorts of things. And I don't have time to read the piece, Setting Up a Headstone, which is pretty much the attack on the funeral home. So I'll go to the Christian offense phase. These are some new poems, and there are some of them that are so new that I discovered that I didn't have copies of all of them. But this one is called Godmother, for Christopher John on Mother's Day. On Mother's Day, in an old Norwegian church with dragons crouched on the roof, I became your godmother. The church is a reproduction, but the floor is cold slate. The backless benches hard, just like the real ones. Those dragons aren't just decorations. One of them snorted fire when I promised to raise you as a Christian. Your father almost winked. Sure, I wouldn't say no before his parents and mine. He knew what I meant by swearing something else. I could teach you how to cheat at solitaire, how to live if you're lost in the hills where you were born, how to ride a horse. But your father can teach you that and more. He'd rather I didn't teach you how to say ERA now. Your mother will teach you to be fair to women, to think before you speak, to work for what you want. I could tell you stories about your dad, your Aunt Sue, your grandparents, show you the home ranch in case they can't. I'm not entirely sure what my job is, but I know that my mute vow covered events none of us have weighed. You cannot say how I might help. You had no choice, being inarticulate, though loud. We'll leave the matter open. If I live, I'll be here when you are old enough to care. If I'm not, you have this pledge, this public statement of my love. I can't promise all who love you will see you grow into a man or that you'll never have to fight for your beliefs. I hope you'll love wolves howling in clean, dark air, moose drinking in a crystal lake, but I can't promise that. So I stand before pure water, between black slate and dragons, make covenant with earth and fire to love you and your sister, whatever that may come to mean. And just one more, and this may run a couple seconds over your allotted time, so I hope you'll hang in there. It's called Thanksgiving Prayer, and this was actually written in Scotland, which is not the Great Plains, as I'm sure you are aware. But it has a great deal in common with the Great Plains. When my husband and I were there, he said the reason I liked it so well was because it was just like the plains, except it was wet. But a lot of the images and a lot of the message in this does come out of the Great Plains. It's called Thanksgiving Prayer. It was written last November. Surrounded by ancient churches, the opulent liquor of entreaty, hymns, and Christian sanctity oozing from their stones, I prayed on the beach, emptied my pockets of stones and shells from the stormy coasts, placed them in a circle around sage from home. Earth lay quiet under my feet. Air swept past in storm clouds. Rain ran down my face. Warmth from my heart and fingers stood for fire, the fourth element. Behind me, the black shadow of a church reaches out from every height in Scotland. Through chaotic centuries, their stone hymns drown screams, the whine of sword blades. Conflicting legends paint their floors with the thick red blood of martyrs. Smoke from human flesh sketches their separate creeds against blue sky. From their aisles blows a chill Christian wind across this land, driving men and women to their knees in the blood of their own ancestors, their own children. The salt stings my throat, scorched raw by years of bawling worship into empty stone naves and vaults, of begging stone-eared saints to turn their sleek smiles on me. My eyes burn with tears for love I'll never know again. Sharp-tongued Quilan hills chant ferocious love from heather heights to blue lakes overflowing with tears. Today he walked beside me. Inside his coat, I crawled down the tunnel to the burial crypt. I did not lie down. Now I stand tall, facing sea wind. White foam sweeps away the lighter stones, the sagebrush and tobacco. I ask only to return to this shore. The salt spray eases the pain in my throat. The hand inside my pocket clutches heather, dug between the standing stones. When I get home, I will plant it on my husband's grave. Thank you very much.
Today on University Forum, we've heard Hermosa, South Dakota writer and rancher Linda Hasselstrom and her lecture, Reaping Literature from the Western Plains. This has been University Forum, a presentation of Nebraska Wesleyan University. Nebraska Wesleyan is an independent coeducational undergraduate liberal arts institution, nationally recognized for excellence in teaching and the high caliber of its students and faculty. Approximately 1,400 full-time students are enrolled in more than 40 major programs.